Coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media, Bay Health is launching a new residency program with an eye toward helping address the need for more doctors in Kent and Sussex counties.
There's a lot of data that supports where physicians do their residency training, and in many instances they continue to reside in that area following the residency.
We talk to Bay Health leadership about the residency program and its potential impact. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also hear more from contributor John Hurdle about concerns over PFAS and possible groundwater contamination in the First State. Plus, poetry takes center stage in this week's Arts Playlist and Enlighten Me segments. It's all next on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground. But first, the latest news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Last October, contributor John Hurdle first reported about concerns over contamination of groundwater by toxic chemicals known as PFAS at Dover Air Force Base and the state's Air National Guard base in Newcastle. Well, that story is not going away. As a matter of fact, concerns about the effects of these chemicals on some public water supplies in Delaware are rising with the announcements of a federal probe into the Newcastle Guard base and a report the Pentagon is seeking to weaken standards for cleaning up contamination at military installations such as Dover Air Force Base. So we asked John Hurdle to update us on these issues and what is and is not being done. His piece is available right now at DelawarePublic.org, and he joined me earlier this week to discuss what he found. So let's just remind listeners first of what you reported on previously. What do we know about the PFAS situation at and around the Dover Air Force Base and the Air National Guard Base in Newcastle?
Some testing was done and on both locations starting in 2014. And the latest data that we've got from the Defense Department for the Dover Base is they've got an eye-poppingly high level of PFAS contamination on that base. Now, it has to be said that this number is in kind of isolated, one or two isolated pockets on the base, but what the DOD is reporting about Dover is that it was up to 2.8 million parts per trillion. Now, what that means is that that's actually something like 250,000 times the limit that the EPA sets as the upper limit for PFAS, a couple of different PFASs in drinking water. So that's a dramatically high level at the Dover base. A spokeswoman for the base has said in recent months that high number is actually unrepresentative. There's a lower number, which is 290,000 parts per trillion, but that in itself is still like 26,000 times higher than the EPA recommends. Clearly they've got some work to do. As far as the Air National Guard base Newcastle is concerned, those levels are lower, but they're still up to 758 times what the EPA's sets as a health limit. So the bottom line here is that PFAS contamination on both of those Delaware bases is very, very high in some places.
The Air National Guard base in Newcastle, one of eight sites the Federal Agency for Toxic Substances and Disease Registry is adding to its investigation into how the chemicals used on the base have affected groundwater there and around it. Tell us a little bit more about what that investigation is and what they'll be doing in and around Newcastle, the base in Newcastle.
Well, their plan is to conduct blood and urine samples on about 400 randomly selected people in each of those eight locations, including Newcastle. They say that they're going to be the tests will start at some point this year, probably go into 2020. The ATSDR, which is a branch of the CDC, is very emphatic. They say that they won't accept anybody who might want to volunteer for these tests because that would interfere with the aim of the tests, which is to establish whether there is exposure to these chemicals on a community-wide basis.
Now, the Dover Air Force Base is not among the sites designated for that study. Do we have an understanding why it's not considering – it would seem like the problem is bigger there?
Well, it would, and unfortunately, we don't know why Dover hasn't been selected and that the Air National Guard place has. I put this question to the office of Senator Tom Carper, who's been very active on the issue of PFAS contamination. And what they said is that the senator accepts that given that there's only 8 locations nationwide that are being selected for this ATSDR study, I think the idea is that it's really quite unlikely that any more than one location would be selected in Delaware. But why that location is the Air National Guard base and not the Dover base, we just don't know. I sent the same question to DENREC, and they just referred me to the ATSDR.
Is anyone looking more closely at Dover and the air base there at this point?
Well, what the Air Force says is that they, for the last couple of years, they've been using a different kind of firefighting foam. Now we should note that the firefighting foam on military bases is the identified source of much of this, or maybe all of this, PFAS contamination. For decades, the military has used different PFAS chemicals in this firefighting foam because of their fire retardant qualities. And so the military's been taking steps to dial back on that. And what they now say is that the foam they're using on the Dover base contains little or maybe even just trace amounts of some of the chemicals. When we're talking about Dover, we should also note that there's concern that any contamination on bases like Dover will get into groundwater that may affect non-military residences nearby. And to that end, in 2017, the DOD tests did find one private well outside the base, which was contaminated with chemicals that were above the EPA level. But all of that information is as of last October when I did the previous reporting on this, and I've just heard in the last few days that the Air Force at Dover hasn't conducted any more tests since then.
What we have learned, has been reported, is that the Pentagon is asking the White House to back raising the level at which it would have to clean up PFAS contamination at military bases around the country. Can you give us a little background on where this stands, this kind of tug of war, and what the implications would be?
The advocates for much tighter control of these chemicals say that the implications would be that people on and around military bases would be exposed to levels of PFAS contamination that are very much higher than what the EPA says is safe from a health point of view. That was a view that was expressed again by Senator Carper in a hearing today of the Senate's Environment and Public Works Committee, on which he's the top Democrat. And the senator was asking witnesses from the EPA and ATSDR and other agencies what the effects would be of these chemicals, and his argument was that it's any weakening of this of the military standards could be very dangerous to people's health.
You mentioned a couple of times that Senator Tom Carper is kind of at the forefront, at least on Capitol Hill, of trying to work on this issue and fighting any weakening of the standard for cleanup. You mentioned he had the hearing this week, or his committee had the hearing this week. What else is he doing on this front?
He has been very active on this. I mean, there's been numerous indications of that. One of them was when the current EPA administrator was up before the EPW committee for his in confirmation hearings, and Senator Carper attempted to ask Andrew Wheeler to get him to commit to setting so-called maximum contaminant limits for a couple of the PFAS chemicals, and then. Following Mr. Wheeler's confirmation, the senator wrote to him urging him to reject any move by the Defense Department to weaken cleanup standards. And he's also authored a PFAS action plan, which would require the EPA to declare these chemicals as hazardous substances.
And what kind of response has he gotten so far from DOD, EPA, and the others he's kind of pushing back on?
Well, I think that was on display in the hearing this week of the committee. He asked David Ross, who is an assistant secretary in the EPA, to commit to a timeline for regulating, for implementing federal regulations on two of these chemicals. And Mr. Ross said it wasn't possible to say when those regulations might be finalized. And he also, Mr. Ross, rejected an accusation by the senator that the EPA has been lacking urgency in its approach to the whole PFAS issue. Mr. Ross said that those comments doing what he called a disservice to many hardworking scientists in the EPA. The other thing to note from the Defense Department's point of view, there was testimony today from Maureen Sullivan, who is an assistant secretary for the environment, and she denied that the Defense Department was seeking weaker standards for its cleanup of PFAS, but she said that they're waiting for the EPA to finalize groundwater standards. Senator Carper didn't sound very satisfied with that answer.
You also note in your piece that some states are setting their own regulations to more strongly protect the public from this type of contamination. Delaware is not one of them. What are some of Delaware's neighbors doing that the Delaware is not?
Well, New Jersey is a national leader on the issue. In the last few years, they have set these so-called maximum contaminant limits, health limits, for three of the chemicals. Just this week, New Jersey's Environment Department announced that five companies will have to pay for PFAS cleanup at various sites over the years. And just yesterday, the New Jersey's Attorney General filed lawsuits against DuPont, Chemours, and 3M over PFAS contamination. So New Jersey is being very proactive on this whole issue in the absence of federal regulation. In Pennsylvania, I think it's probably fair to say that Pennsylvania is not as far along, but in the last month or so, the Wolf administration has begun the process of setting MCLs for two of the chemicals. Last September, Governor Wolf set up an action team to deal with the issue, and just in the last couple of days, announced $8 million for the cleanup of 17 water wells in Bucks County, where in an area which is near to another military base, which is seen as the source of a lot of contamination.
Any indication Delaware might be inclined to do more like these other states?
Not immediately. DENREC is working with EPA and ATSDR on these issues, on PFAS in general and on the military bases in particular. And I know that the Department of Health is also involved in these discussions, and they have said a few months ago that there was no need for any emergency action as regarding the water supplies around the Dover base.
What are the likely next steps in how PFAS is addressed nationwide in here? Is there kind of a path forward we're seeing develop at all?
Well, I think the focus is going to remain on the states. For a long time, advocates have been, criticizing, in fact, the federal government for failing to regulate these chemicals amid increasing signs that they are actually a threat to public health. As we've heard, the EPA is only now just beginning its process of regulating two of the chemicals. As New Jersey has shown, in the last approximately the last 5 years, they've made great strides. In Pennsylvania, when Pennsylvania announced that they were going to be beginning the process of setting their own health limits, Governor Wolf made a statement saying that the people of Pennsylvania couldn't wait for the federal government to decide whether or how it's going to set these limits. I mean, the other thing to note on the federal level is that there has been, and I think continues to be, some confusion over exactly what limits, what health limits are set by different federal agencies. Last year, the ATSDR came out with a set of recommendations that were significantly lower than that published by the EPA. And there was an indication that there's still some confusion over that issue, judging by some of the questions during the committee hearing today. So I think there's the states are going to continue to make the running on this issue.
Thanks to contributor John Hurdle for his time on The Green this week. John's piece on the groundwater contamination at military installations in the first state is available right now at DelawarePublic.org. Next, Delaware Public Media's Nick Shalino reports on how a new residency program downstate could help lure doctors to areas they're needed most. Stay with us. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. Bay Health says it plans to launch a residency program for doctors who have recently graduated medical school. Delaware Public Media's Nick Shalino spoke with Bay Health President and CEO Terry Murphy and Bay Health's Chief Medical Officer Dr. Gary Siegelman about this attempt to try and address the lack of physicians in the state of Delaware.
We're going to start with a question for Terry. And I think it may be the issue that is most important to Delawareans. There is, of course, a shortage of physicians in the state, particularly in Sussex and Kent counties, particularly in the area of primary care. Can you tell me how this residency program seeks to address that issue?
So the residency program seeks to address the physician-to-population issues in Kent and Sussex County by providing residency training for physicians who have graduated and to provide their residency experience as a way to retain those physicians, hopefully, once they complete their residency. There's a lot of data that supports where physicians do their residency training, and in many instances, they continue to reside in that area following the residency, and it is probably the most substantial thing that we could do in order to help address the physician-to-population ratio in Kent and Sussex County. So we are making a large commitment, and we think it will help reduce the declines that we've seen in primary care physicians and help stem that tide.
All right, and then I'd like to follow up with Dr. Siegelman. Can you just tell me about the nuts and bolts of the program and how it works in recruiting doctors from medical schools to come do their residency here in the first state?
Sure, absolutely. So we build the structure of the program first, and we go through an application process with a national accrediting body. Our plan, and all signs are very positive at this point, is we will have five different residency programs. They'll exist at both campuses, so the residents will go back and forth between our Sussex and our Kent campus and outpatient sites. The five residencies would be family medicine, internal medicine, general surgery, emergency medicine, and what we call a transitional year, which is a year of general training that then helps someone go on to fellowships. So those five residencies, we're anticipating we would have about close to 100 residents in total. That number could change. We could increase it, but I don't think it would diminish very much. So our first program would be initiated, first two programs in July of 2021, so a little over 2 years from now. And those two programs are going to be internal medicine and family medicine. So those are a couple basics. I can give you more information if you like.
Yeah, absolutely. So it would start with the two programs, and the other programs would roll out gradually?
Correct. So in 2022, we would probably roll out surgery, and in 2023, emergency medicine and the transitional year programs. We already have hired the first program director. Her name is Dr. Brintha Vassigar, and she'll be the program director for the family medicine residency. And we're recruiting for the other of the early programs, which is internal medicine, where we're interviewing candidates currently.
Want to cover undergraduate medical education?
Thanks, Terry. Another thing that we're doing in preparation is developing a core of faculty members, and there's been tremendous excitement from our medical staff. We had at the press conference, I don't know if you were in attendance, we had about 100 physicians that attended, roughly. What we're doing to help them develop their skills as educators is we're expanding our undergraduate medical education. So we are beginning this July as a core clinical campus for PCOM, Philadelphia College of Osteopathic Medicine. And we'll have 11 students here, third-year medical students for the whole year, and they'll do all their third-year clinical rotations with us. So, and we'll have more fourth-year students as well. So as we start to do more of that education, we're developing teaching skills, but then those medical students, if we're comfortable with them and vice versa, they can apply for residencies here and perhaps be some of our first residents.
And Nick, I would just add that there has been such a great support from our medical staff. Gary mentioned the 100 or so physicians that were part of the announcement, but there is an extreme level of excitement to incorporate teaching within their profession. And that also helps us retain physicians as we become teaching hospitals. That helps us retain physicians who want to have teaching as part of their work and part of what they give back to the profession. So there's just a great deal of engagement by physicians related to undergraduate and graduate medical education at Bay Health.
Yes, I was going to ask you what this means for the culture at Bay Health to add this education component.
So the education and the teaching is such a strong component of an organization and a culture. Not only teaching between the physicians and the residents, the teaching of the residents to the physicians on things that may be new in the particular specialty, the teaching between the nurses and the residents, and vice versa. So that teaching just elevates, excellence and collaboration by everyone taking care of patients in Kent and Sussex.
Nick, if I could add something to that, just about the teaching, I think one of the things that we're looking at carefully is what are we going to teach? So there's a lot of all the traditional material that residents will need to learn about various diseases and how to diagnose and manage them. But there's a lot of other things that are very important today. So we have some capabilities already in teaching preventive health care, dealing with populations and how you keep populations healthy when they're at home so they can stay at home and not have to be, get sick again and again. We will teach things about how to be a good caregiver in the sense of how to take care of patients and their families from an interpersonal perspective as well. A lot about patient safety too. So there's a variety of different things that go along with some of the traditional teachings, which we're excited about having on our curriculum as well.
That sounds a bit like value-based care contract models. The idea of, as I understand it, you're teaching the students to care for population health and also to try to get positive health outcomes from patients to avoid them ending up in the emergency department. Terry, is Bay Health have any value-based contracts with any of the payers?
So right now we participate in what I would call a risk-based arrangement with Medicare, which is our largest payer. So we participate with Christiana Care Health System, BB Healthcare, and Anacoke Health Services in what's called an accountable care organization. So we are already working with our primary care physicians on managing a population, and Bay Health and its primary care physicians are doing very well in managing that population and managing the cost of how we take care of that population as well. So we're doing very well. We've also just signed into doing what's called a bundled payment clinical initiative in which we are paid a flat rate for a bundle of care of different types of diseases. So we're doing a lot of that, and that's why the training and teaching related to population health is a very important part of what the physicians that will be coming through the residency will be able to develop quite well.
I'd like to bring it back to the physician shortage here in Delaware, particularly, again, in primary care. Kent and Sussex were both designated as shortage areas, having more than 2,000 patients per primary care physician. It sounds like this residency program is going to go quite a ways into helping with that problem. But the fact remains that doctors here in Delaware are reimbursed less than they are in neighboring states. And while we did pass legislation last year to raise it to at least the Medicare rate, doctors that I have conversations with around the state still say it's more profitable to start a practice in some of the neighboring states. Do you feel that more legislation is necessary to really deal with this problem?
I don't think so. This is so our move into the residency program, I think, is the biggest impact that we can have on the physician shortage. And it's not just in Delaware, it's across the country. It's one step. We have a whole host of folks that do physician recruitment and are actively involved. Our primary care physicians are actively involved. So I would say that it's a myriad approach in how we attract and bring physicians in. And all those things are ongoing at Bay Health. Gary?
I think we certainly want to have a state where the conditions to practice medicine and take care of patients are conducive and help you do so without too much hassle, without very low reimbursement. So I think your points are very important. There are requirements and restrictions and administrative burden that can be a big frustration and barrier to physicians getting their work done and taking care of patients. And the reimbursement is always somewhat of an issue. But as Terry said, you know, given where we are now, how do we move forward? And, you know, this is one way to bring resident trainees into the community, and they get to know the community, and they are more likely to stay. It's the way things, you know, it's been a historical fact for years. Just a comment. I mean, there's several reports, and one was recent by the state Department of Health and Human Services that showed that the numbers of primary care physicians in Kent and Sussex counties have both declined over the last 5 years, in spite of the fact that the population is growing and they're also aging and need more services. So it goes to your point about there being a significant need.
Yes, it is a need, but it sounds like this residency program could be a step in the right direction. Is there anything either of you would like to add about the program itself that maybe we didn't go over?
It's a Bay Health program, but we are communicating with and partnering with others in healthcare. So we're working with, as I mentioned, PCOM on the undergraduate education, bringing more of their third and fourth year students. We've talked with the FQHC, the federally qualified health centers in the area, and how we can work together on possibly doing some training work together. So there, we can partner with others in the state to do this as well.
And I would just I would finish by saying this is a significant investment and commitment by the Bay Health organization to tackle something that over the next 10 or 20 years will continue to be an issue as people age and more people come to the state. So that growth and aging of the population will require really strong primary care, and we think this goes a long way to closing that gap.
Thanks to Bay Health President and CEO Terry Murphy and Bay Health's Chief Medical Officer Dr. Gary Siegelman, as well as our Nick Schellino, for joining us on The Green this week. And The Green continues in a moment with Art's Playlist. You're listening to Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. There's a new public art installation in Wilmington's Creative District. The 8x12-foot mural is a collaboratively written poem called 19 Questions, and is displayed on a mural-style background at the Episcopal Church of Saints Andrew and Matthew on North Shipley Street. The church collaborated with the Creative District and University of Delaware students under the direction of Professor of English and Creative Writing David Teague on this year-long project, which received $3,600 in funding from UD's Partnership for Arts and Culture. In this week's Arts Playlist, Delaware Public Media's Kelly Steele chats with Teague about 19 questions and how this project came together.
Professor, thank you for joining me.
My pleasure.
Talk to me about this collaboration and about the mural.
The mural is on the wall of the Saints Andrew and Matthew Church at the corner of 8th and Shipley Street in downtown Wilmington. The church is our neighbor. The University of Delaware Associate in Arts program is also in downtown Wilmington. And so the public installation, which is a poem called 19 Questions, was a collaboration between the Creative District of Wilmington, the church and its parishioners, and my creative writing and leadership students. So it was a big pot of people. It was a very diverse group by age and experience. And we were fortunate to be funded by a grant from the University of Delaware's Partnership for Arts and Culture, which is part of the Community Engagement Initiative at UD. So it was a great opportunity to get to know our neighbors. University of Delaware has had the Associate in Arts program here since, I think, 2004. Before that, we were the parallel program, which began here in, I believe, 1972. And so we've been neighbors with the church. We've been neighbors with our, our friends who walk up and down Market Street all these years. And, I started to feel like you feel in your own neighborhood when you have a neighbor who's lived there a while, but you guys have never connected. And so the time has passed when you can actually ask one another's names. So you just walk past and nod, hoping you'll never be called on that. So I sort of felt like we needed this reason, to get to know our neighbors on a really meaningful level. And I'm a poetry professor. I'm a creative writer, so the way in for me was through the written word, and I feel like there's some things people can always talk about, right? Food, sports, art, and so that, I believe, is what underlies the Partnership for Arts and Culture, and that's what my creative writers wanted to accomplish with the poem. So we began work last spring of 2018. And at that time, that was the 50th anniversary of the occupation of Wilmington by the National Guard for 9 months. And we, as young people, my students are 18 and 19, had very little concept of this. So we began by collecting stories, and we were looking at the past, and we were looking at all the reasons we suspected that Wilmington is really struggling to find its renaissance. We were looking at the reasons that Market Street looks the way it does at 8 o'clock when my students walk down there, a bit deserted, not always at its best. So we began to ask questions. We know that the what is some people call the riots, what some people call the occupation, had really torn the fabric of Wilmington. And we talked to people who'd been there, a man named Matt Shipp, who was a policeman at the time. He was an African-American police sergeant who served the police force during the riots and the occupation. We went to the elder storytelling group at Saints Andrew and Matthew Church and listened to elders talk about their experiences. The Reverend Lloyd Casson, who had been a young clergyman at the time, talked about the feeling of going over into West Center City to calm the city and being shot at. He talked about the anger he felt and how, even as a young clergyman who was a follower of Dr. King and nonviolence, his anger when Dr. King was murdered was so great that he found himself feeling like, the city should burn. So we just had all these impressions from the past. But as we talked to people, especially those who had been there, we began to realize that many folks were also wanting to talk about the future. I know when we talked to B.B. Coker, who was an activist and is, she had sort of said all she had to say about the past and wanted to talk about the future, which is where the structure of our poem came in. It's a question poem. It's modeled on something, Walt Whitman often wrote question poems. Walt Whitman, being Walt, would write one question and spend, 70 lines answering it, which
you know, was a bit slower. The pace of a poem like that was a bit slower than what we wanted. So we jammed all our questions together. We made literally 19 questions, and then the final stanza is an answer, or at least a response to some of the questions we asked. So that's how the poem came about. It took longer than we expected. Of course, everybody wanted it to be done in a semester, but nothing ever works out neatly on a 13-week schedule. So in the spring, we wrote and planned and basically made connections, and the poem was finished. My creative writers had finished it by the end of the spring session of 2018. Over the summer, we did a handoff, and we then had a group of leadership students take on as project the actual production of the mural, the attachment to the wall, the planning of a dedication ceremony. And that became a chance for three of my younger, my 18 and 19-year-olds, to stand up in front of a group of people at the church and present the idea, to do a workshop, to take feedback, to work with a graphic artist, to work with the creative district with Lars Sommerhoff, and really think about the logistical and financial aspects of administering this grant, making the money go all the way to the end of the project. So we never at any moment knew. In fact, I was just saying Sunday, I never really fully believed that mural would end up on a wall somewhere in Wilmington. I wanted it to. I knew that there were a lot of challenges, and the fact that we actually came up with an art installation, a bunch of first year writing students and first year leadership students really finished the project. I think that's the goal of any teaching experience, to teach people how to finish. So I have to say I was very proud of everyone.
We're talking to Professor David Teig of UD's Associate in Arts program about a UD student-designed mural unveiled in the Creative District, Wilmington. What is the name of the poem again and the location, just so everybody knows?
The name is 19 Questions, the numeral 19 Questions. You can see it on the side of St. Andrew and Matthew Church. So that church is located between Shipley and Orange Street on 8th. So that's the location of the church. And you can park in their parking lot, I think, probably during the day. Or you can drive, if you're going into town, on Orange Street, going north, crossing 7th. Look on your right, you'll see it from your car.
And Professor, how long will this mural be there, forever and ever?
The mural is designed, the process is designed to last for 3 years. So it's printed, it's stretched on sign material, and our goal is, for one thing, there are 19 questions we'd like to write a poem to answer each one and begin to put those up. So we see it as a dynamic, a living process. But the intended shelf life of this installation of the poem anyway is 3 years.
And the cost of this, you said you had a grant to pay for all of this.
Well, I can say we did this all for about, $3,600 in cash and a lot of in-kind contributions from amazing partners like St. Andrew and Matthew Church, like the Creative District. So there was some moving of resources and assets, but there was also, that was a fairly good budget. I think we did a great job managing our money.
How big is the mural?
The mural is 8 by 12. It's about the same size as an average parking spot.
Okay. And I assume that the students involved in this, they must just be ecstatic.
They're very proud. We were able to present to a national conference of community engagement scholars down at UD a couple weeks ago. The provost for engagement of the University of Iowa came up to us. The dean at Washington University in St. Louis came up and wanted to talk to the students. They just said, "Hey, Professor Teig, let's talk to your kids." And it made them so proud of themselves in the best way. But yeah, they're published. I mean, how many poets are published? You never get published if you're a poet, but we're literally, we're public and published. Everybody sees this poem every day. I think there have to be, 7 million poets around the country who would give a leg to be where they are.
And as you said, a great collaboration between UD's Partnership for Arts and Culture, the Episcopal Church of Saints Andrew and Matthew, and the Creative District of Wilmington.
Right. Everybody plays. Everybody has a voice. And I do think, we all talk about how we want to exchange stories with one another. We want to know one another's narrative, but I think we also want to know one another's poems. You know, the what's metaphorical in your life? What are your aspirations? What are these ineffable parts of you and your experience, the things that poems do that narratives don't always get to? I mean, I can see what you did, you know, A, B, C, D in your story, and that says a lot. But when we start looking at the more speculative parts of one another's lives, we share something different. And I think, you know, that's what Walt Whitman was after. He once said, "The Americans, of all people in all nations on the earth, have probably the fullest poetic nature." And then he said, "The United States themselves are essentially the greatest poem." And that's a great way to think about, especially now, right? We're feeling like we don't communicate in our culture. I think to think of our experiences as one big poem is a great vision, and I feel like that's what we were approaching when we put the 19 questions on the wall.
Thanks to UD English and creative writing professor David Teague and R. Kelly Steele for their time on this week's Arts Playlist. And stay with us. Kelly Steele returns with more poetry next in this week's Enlighten Me, where she introduces us to this year's Delaware Poetry Out Loud champion. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green this week. I'm Tom Byrne. A senior from Hodgson Votek High School in Glasgow is Delaware's 2019 Poetry Out Loud Delaware State Champion. Chelsea Anoche Ajay came out on top, emerging from an initial field of 20 First State High School students and then 12 state finalists. In this week's Enlighten Me, Chelsea chats with Delaware Public Media's Kelly Steele about her win and offers some poetry readings.
Congratulations, young lady.
Thank you.
Hey, tell me about poetry, and what is it about poetry that inspires you?
With poetry, I feel like you can really interpret it your own way. You can turn it into something and how you feel. There's no set one way on how to say one specific poem. You can have one poem, and you can say it in multiple ways. So that's what I really like about poetry. It's all up for interpretation.
Do you write your own poetry?
That's something I started recently, not before, but since doing this competition, it's something that I definitely have been looking into and trying out.
All right. Now, your final recitation at the state finals in Smyrna in February, you recited The Albatross by Kate Bass, and that apparently earned you very high marks with the judges. What was some of the feedback? We're going to get you to read that poem to us, but what was some of the feedback you got from the judges?
I just think they liked how it was contemporary and it was something different. Listening to this poem, you just have to feel, and you know, it's all about how you're presenting the poem, and I feel like they liked it because it's a very, you know, hidden meaning type of poem, where that means there's a lot of, you know, hidden meanings throughout the lines. It's not always clear. So I think that's what he liked about it.
Who is your favorite poet?
My favorite poet would be Ellen Watkins Harper. I read one of her poems last year in the competition. I just like how her poems is really like, you know, a calling kind of.
All right. So again, your final recitation, The Albatross by Kate Bass. Read us some passages, if not the whole entire poem, please.
Okay. So The Albatross by Kate Bass. When I know you're coming home, I put on this necklace. Glass beads on silken thread, a blue that used to match my eyes. I like to think I'm remembering you. I like to think you don't forget. The necklace lies heavy on my skin. It clatters when I reach down to lift my screaming child. I swing her, rolling my arms until she forgets. The bleeds glitter in the flicker of a TV set. As I sit her on my lap and wish away the afternoon, I wait until I hear a gate latch lift, the turn of key and lock. I sit amongst toys and unwashed clothes. I sit and she fingers the beads until you speak in a voice that no longer seems familiar, only strange. I turn as our child tugs at the string. I hear a snap and a sound like Falling Rain.
Thank you so much. I can understand why that was the winning poem. Again, we're talking to Chelsea Anoche Ajay. She is the winner of the 2019 Poetry Out Loud Delaware State Contest. She is the champion. The finals held in Smyrna back in February. And for your winning presentation, I understand you received $200 and an all-expense-paid trip to D.C. to compete at the national championship. What's that like? Are you excited for that opportunity?
Yes, this is so real, kind of. You know, I hoped and prayed that I would make it this far, but, you know, there was always that little bit of doubt. But now that I've made it, I feel more confident. I'm excited and I'm ready to go.
What about your parents, Chelsea? They must be very proud of you.
Yes, I live with my mom, and she was definitely really shocked and proud. You know, like I said, this something like this hasn't really happened to me before, and you know, it's a chance for me to represent, you know, Delaware, and I'm very honored to have that chance.
That's fantastic. All right, we're going to talk to your teacher, Mr. Christopher Vella. Sir, you must be very proud of your student.
Oh, we're all very proud of her. It was definitely an amazing moment to hear her name called out.
Did you help her decide on her winning poem, the final poem for her to read?
No, when it comes to the choice of poems, Chelsea was really all over that. She had complete control of it.
Talk to me about what kind of a student Chelsea is.
She's an amazing student. In a 10th grade honors class, she definitely stood out.
That's great. Anything else about the poetry class that she is in? Where do we go from here with the rest of the year and with Chelsea as your student?
You know, this is our third year running the poetry club. And, you know, so far Chelsea has gone the furthest with it. We're just excited for her and we're ready for her to go to D.C.
Now, will you be there in D.C. when she goes to the Nationals?
Yeah, that's the plan, and I can't wait to see her come up on that stage and perform.
Hey, Chelsea, any final words? You're such a bright young lady. You're very well-spoken, and again, I want to say congratulations to you. Good luck in the finals. Any final words? Would you like to read another one of your poems, maybe a favorite that you have?
I do have a couple final words, and I can recite a poem if you would like.
Okay.
I would just say that take advantage of the opportunities that are presented to you. You never know where anything can lead. And my parents, you know, they're originally from Ghana, Africa, and opportunities like this, you know, don't come. So me being here, I really appreciate, you know, having the opportunities given to me and taking them and running with them and seeing how far I can get. And, yeah, so use the opportunities you have very wisely.
That's fantastic. All right, what's the name of this poem that you're going to read to take us out?
Okay, it's called Sit and Sew by Alice Moore Dunbar Nelson. I sit and sew, a useless task it seems. My hands grown tired, my head weighed down with dreams. The panoply of war, the martial tread of men, grim-faced, stern-eyed, gazing beyond the ken of lesser souls whose eyes have not seen death, nor learned to hold their lives but as a breath. But I must sit and sew. I sit and sew. My heart aches with desire. That pageant terrible, that fiercely pouring fire on wasted fields and writhing grotesque things once men. My soul in pity flings appealing cries, yearning only to go there in that holocaust of hell, those fields of woe. But I must sit and sew the little useless seam, the idle patch. Why dream I here beneath my homely thatch when there they lie in sudden mud and rain, pitifully calling me the cook ones and the slain? You need me, Christ. It is no roseate dream that beckons me. This pretty futile scene, it stifles me. God, must I sit and sew?
Thanks to 2019 Delaware Poetry Out Loud champ Chelsea Anoche Ajay for enlightening us this week. Again, Chelsea will represent the First State in the 2019 Poetry Out Loud National Finals in Washington, D.C., April 29th through May 1st. We wish her the best of luck. And that's all we have time for On the Green this week. The stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to the Green's page on our website. And remember, you can also check out the Green via podcast at our website, on iTunes, and on the NPR One app. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page, on Twitter at TheGreenDE, or by emailing us at TheGreen@DelawarePublic.org. Thanks to all those who helped make today's show possible, contributor John Hurdle, and Delaware Public Media's Nick Shalino and Kelly Steele. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Burns saying thanks for joining us, and we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground.